Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples. Dress listeners, if you suffer from seasonal allergies like me, Astapro is your new go-to. It has been super helpful to me this spring as it bursts into full bloom.
And that's because Astapro is the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter solution for nasal allergy symptoms. Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes while other allergy sprays take hours.
Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray, and Astapro delivers full prescription strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing. You too can get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief like I have with Astapro. It gets me back in the game, ready to record the show for all of you.
Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can Astapro and go today. That's Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Menopause, perimenopause, these can be some of the most uncomfortable phases of a woman's life. If you find yourself in either of these, well, Hormone Harmony is here for you. Hormone Harmony capsules contain science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. Now, here's the beauty about adaptogens. They help the body adapt to any stressors, like chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life.
Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier. And that means using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work for women. They make no compromise when it comes to quality, and it really shows.
And get this, Hormone Harmony isn't just for menopause. Any woman with symptoms of hormonal imbalances can take it. But it is perfect for those horrible menopause symptoms that put a woman's life on hold.
And for a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code DRESSED at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code DRESSED for 15% off today.
Dressed, the History of Fashion, is a production of iHeartRadio. With over 7 billion people in the world, we all have one thing in common. Every day, we all get dressed.
Welcome to Dressed, the History of Fashion, a podcast that explores the who, what, when of why we wear. We are fashion historians and your hosts, Cassidy Zachary
and April Callahan. Cass, I'm going to guess that more than one of our listeners today are going to have a real-time, firsthand experience while listening to this episode, because I bet many, many of you out there are wearing one of the most ubiquitous garments on the planet. I am, of course, speaking of jeans.
Yes, and I am wearing jeans as we record this podcast. Today, listeners, we bring you a much requested episode on the history of denim and jeans. Emma McClendon, who is the Associate Curator of Costume at the Museum at FIT, joins us again. She was on last season, but she's here today to talk about her fascinating work on denim.
And debunk a possible myth or two about the origins of denim. In fact, ones that we ourselves as fashion historians have subscribed to in the past. And it is such a gift that so many wonderful scholars from all around the world have agreed to join us on the show and to share their realms of research. I can honestly say that I have learned so much from our guests making the show the past 2 years.
I wholeheartedly agree. And actually, this brings up a point, Dressed listeners. This is actually our final episode for season 2 of Dressed. We are actually going to take a much needed break for the holidays, but we will be back with a brand new season starting first week of February. And, you know, we chose denim as this topic as so many of you have asked for this, you know, so we kind of thought it would be perfect for our end of season 2. But you know, don't worry, we'll be back in season 3 in February, and just taking some much needed R&R for the holidays. So without further ado, the always infectious and talented Emma McClendon, welcome to the show.
Emma, welcome back to the show. And I say welcome back because you are actually one of our very first guests on Dressed when we started nearly 2 years ago. You spoke to us about your exhibition that was up at the time at the Museum at FIT, Fashion and Physique. And honestly, that episode still remains to this day one of the episodes that we've gotten the most comments and feedback on.
Oh, good.
Yeah. And I think you really made an impact with a lot of our listeners in terms of talking about the way that we have historically thought about our bodies and the legacy of that way of thinking that remains with us today. So thank you and welcome back.
It's always a pleasure to be here. I love the podcast, listen to it myself. And it was just so fun coming in and speaking last time about all things the body. And so I'm just happy to come and talk about another avenue of research I've done on denim and all things jeans, and it'll be fun.
Yeah. And this has actually been a much requested topic from our listeners. So I know this may be a very basic question for you. And I'm guessing that nearly all of our listeners own a denim garment. Because as you know in your book, denim is by far the most worn textile on the planet. Mm. But technically speaking, what is denim?
You know, it's funny. In thinking about this question, it does seem so basic. What is denim? But actually, when I was doing research for the exhibition, I was surprised by how complicated that question got, sort of this rabbit hole that kept going down, because denim is a textile with a long history. Mm-hmm. And anybody who's familiar with textiles knows that technology plays a huge role.
Right.
Fibers and how they're developed. And so textiles can evolve drastically. Technically speaking, if you ask, you know, a real denim head, denim obsessed connoisseur, they will say that denim is a warp face twill made out of cotton. So it's using a cotton thread for both the warp and the weft threads. And it's got the twill weave. So it's really kind of almost ribbed feeling, very structured, very sturdy. And it's warp faced, which means that the warp basically sits on top. And another requirement typically for denim is that the warp threads are blue. Mm-hmm. Often, and that they're not just blue, but they're dyed blue in a particular way, either through rope dyeing or long chain dyeing. And what that does is it creates a pattern in the threads of the textile itself, so that the blue dye, because of the process of dipping the threads, taking them back out, dipping them again, you don't have the blue color seep all the way through the natural cotton fiber. Instead, it only seeps through just at the edges, leaving the core of the thread basically white or natural cotton color. And that's where we get the fade pattern on jeans, because those blue warp threads are sitting on top. It's a warp face twill, so they're sitting on top on the face of the denim. And then over time, as you brush your hands on the top of your pants, as you kind of get up, sit down, you know, pull things in and out of your pockets, you're slowly taking some of that blue dye off. And as it comes off, the core of the white thread in the middle gets exposed over and over in increasing patterns. So that's what people really think of when they think of denim. But when, as I was looking, you know, now you go into a store and there's stretch in denim. They're not all blue. They're not even all the same weight or even that warp face twill weave, but we still identify them as denim. And I would argue that they're not denim. You know, it's showing how the textile has continued to stay relevant and pick up and incorporate different aspects of the times. When I was doing the show in the catalog, I actually, sort of nerd alert, equated this.
We like nerd alerts.
Equated this with Plutarch's paradox of Theseus's ship. This is a story about how Theseus, you know, the famous hero of Greek mythology, how in Athens they kept his ship as this sort of commemorative statue monument to this hero. But that over time, you know, the planks wore out, the masts wore out. They had to, you know, bring in new replacement parts so that over time, the entire ship was replaced. Can that ship, made entirely out of new component parts, still be called Theseus's ship?
Right.
you know, it's a paradox. There's not, you know, necessarily a right or a wrong answer. And I just kept on feeling like that with denim. We replace the threads. We change the color. We replace the weave. Is it still denim?
Mm-hmm.
And again, I don't think there's a right or a wrong answer. There's some connoisseurs out there who are going to say, no, that's not denim. But I would say that it is. Culturally and socially, it is denim.
Yeah. Well, and there are also, I think, some other textiles that are denim-esque, that people identify as denim.
Yes.
Which are not.
Right.
Like chambray.
Yes.
For instance.
Chambray is absolutely the classic example. You know, you'll go onto J. Crew or what have you and see a denim shirt. Quote-unquote. Mm-hmm. You know, it's basically a blue shirt, blue and white-looking, denim-esque shirt. But really, it's chambray. And
right.
The key difference between chambray and denim is that chambray is a plain weave textile. And it's weaving blue and white threads together, which give it that kind of denim look, but it doesn't have that double-layered warp-faced twill that
right.
you really sort of recognize the denim. A surefire way most of the time, and again, this doesn't work all the time because of how denim, you know, multifaceted it is now, but usually a surefire way to see if something's sort of denim or something chambray is to flip it over,
mm-hmm.
you know, turn it inside out. A true denim usually will be white on the inside of the pant leg. You know, that's why when you cuff a jean,
right,
you know, you see that different
tone,
color.
Yeah.
And that's because the weft is sitting on the bottom and the warp is sitting on the top. So you have those two different colors. But with a chambray, it's just a plain weave. You know, you're just weaving those two fibers together and it's going to look the same on the top and the bottom.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about the origin of denim, which also is not as straightforward
yes.
as one might think. There are several different myths that kind of swirl around the origin of denim. What can you tell us about this?
Well, so the most popular myth is that it's French and that the name denim comes from French de Nîmes or of Nîmes, Nîmes being a city that's in the south of France. Now, there's a lot of reasons to kind of doubt this, but it's thought that denim is most likely actually a British textile. One of the reasons being that the English were vital in developing technology in not just the weaving process, but also the spinning of threads and the spinning of cotton threads to make them strong enough to attach to a loom and to be the warp thread of a loom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that requires a really durable fiber. And cotton for so long was actually quite weak as a fiber in these long threads. But anyway, the key thing is that they think that likely the British maybe gave the fabric a French-sounding name to give it a certain je ne sais quoi on the market. There's also, you know, a number of other myths about the name for jean, you know, and how that comes from Italian and Genoa and the Genovese sailors and all of this. But again, what I found most interesting in my research was just how murky the origin story really is.
Mm-hmm.
That when you look at the histories that have been written and the research that has been done, people have import manifests into the U.S., from the 18th century, where you see both denim and jean listed. So it's clear that there hasn't always been such a strict definition of these fabrics, and that really it was one of a family of durable workwear material. And there's the potential that what people were referring to as denim or as jean in the 18th and the 17th century maybe would look very different than what we have today.
Right. Well, you know, where or exactly when denim first emerged may never exactly be clear.
Absolutely.
We don't know. But what we definitely know is that by the 19th century, it was a very well-respected textile, prized for its durability and strength, especially in the United States
yes.
at this point. Can you speak about this relationship between denim work and quote-unquote Americanness?
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously American identity, Americanness is one of the things most associated with denim. And I don't think that that's bad or that that's wrong. But I think that there's a much more nuanced history to sort of denim and labor and America and mm-hmm. American sociopolitical demographics. Because the reality is that when we think of denim as workwear, we have this really romanticized view of the California gold rush prospector, mm-hmm. you know.
Cowboys.
Yeah, cowboys, the West and the great wide open plain and riding off on your horseback into the sunset. And it's not to say so much that that's not a part of this history, but it's more that the history encompasses so much more. For example, in the museum at FIT in our collection, we have a woman's workwear jacket from mm-hmm. the early 19th century that's made out of denim. And this would have been something that a woman would have worn probably when working in the fields, laboring out of doors. And when we talk about that in the 19th century, the reality is we're talking about slavery. Mm-hmm. So slaves were wearing denim as much as miners and prospectors were wearing denim. Also, even though we're thinking about it with predominantly white cowboys and that sort of Marlboro Man image that has become such a sort of idol mm-hmm. of American culture, we also have to realize that the Chinese immigrant workforce building the Transcontinental Railway were wearing denim. They mm-hmm. were wearing jeans. They were wearing overalls. So, yes, part of the West, part of the expansion of the West, but maybe not the romantic, nostalgic view that was always picked up on. Mm-hmm. So I think that there is a schism, in a way, between the lived American experience of denim as it happened throughout history and the view that we take of denim, the popular mythology of denim and its link to Americanness that we have now. And it's important for us to kind of try to reconcile the two and sort of understand why they developed in the way that they did without erasing from the history the very real and hardworking reality of denim's past in this country, mm-hmm. sort of at all levels and across the country and, you know, across races and ages.
In the context of Americanness, and also I think you said the phrase legend of denim. I love that. What could possibly be more American than Hollywood?
Yeah.
Who contributed greatly to this legend of denim.
Absolutely.
And also an entire love affair with denim,
yes.
especially in the 1950s.
Yes.
So not only in terms of Western wear, because of course Western movies were very popular, but also that of the quote-unquote uniform of the bad boy heartthrob.
Oh, yes.
How has denim functioned historically as a symbol of rebellion at certain points in time?
So what's interesting for me is that I don't actually see the figure of the rebel as being that distinct from the figure of the cowboy.
Mm-hmm.
They're very much related. It's just one is a pre-World War II. And one is post-war. But in many ways, when you look at them, they are both the lone individual man. One is the, you know, cowboy outlaw in the Wild West railroad setting, and one is the member of the biker gang on his Harley. In both cases, they're wearing their Levi's 501s and their boots. On one hand, they're cowboy boots. On the other hand, they're biker boots. They both have their animal hide jacket. One, it's a suede fringe jacket for the cowboy. And then you've got the Perfecto jacket for the biker on his Harley. And then they both got their hats as well. You just swap the horse for the Harley.
Mm-hmm.
And they're so similar. And so I think that it is very much a product of the kind of broader culture in which they're introduced, you know, that sort of pre-war, there is this sort of romantic notion and a sort of general curiosity and cultural sort of embrace of this cowboy figure. Whereas after the war, you know, we culturally, there is a move towards a much more conservative outlook
right.
and a kind of coming home and wanting to protect and create a sort of Eden-like suburb. Right. And the cowboy lone sort of figure, but now as the Harley riding biker gang member, is an affront to that suburban ideal. And so jeans begin to represent this danger.
Right.
This danger to this ideal environment and safety and everything that it entails. And so that's absolutely just so crucial. And then you have figures like Elvis Presley with his, you know, denim jeans and his hips swiveling. And, you know, it's completely, you know, erotic and sexual and scary to that sort of suburban landscape. And then it gets really solidified even more by the counterculture movement of the hippies.
Right.
Once the hippies adopt the ripped, pre-worn, embroidered denim jeans as their de facto uniform, jeans are completely cemented as a counterculture image. And since then, we've really seen almost every counterculture and subculture movement have their version of wearing denim.
Yeah. We are going to take a short sponsor break, but when we come back, we're going to talk about the flip side from counterculture, and we're going to talk about the world of designer denim.
Ooh.
Welcome back, Emma. Designer denim wasn't always a thing. Before there was designer denim, there were the big three. So for more than a century, there were kind of only like a handful of major denim brands. Who were they, and what also were their contributions to the popularity of jeans?
So the most important historical companies are without a doubt Levi's and also Lee. The sort of third in that trifecta is Wrangler, but actually Wrangler doesn't come onto the scene until the 30s and 40s. And it's really a product of the sort of cowboy Hollywood whole thing. But for the better part of a century, you know, Levi's first, but and then Lee were creating workwear out of denim. You know, that was their thing, and that's all denim was. Before Hollywood and the cowboy movies come along, denim is not romantic. It's not nostalgic. It is workwear, full stop. There's no other reason you would wear jeans other than you are working in a garage, you're a mechanic, you are a miner, you're a farmer, you know, you are doing hard labor and you're wearing these things. And typically also these denim garments are protective layers that are meant to be worn over other day clothes. You know, jeans, Levi's in their first, what we now know as the 501, when it was first sort of patented in 1873, it was dubbed the waist overalls. They weren't called jeans.
Right.
And it was because they were, you know, meant to, and they even had sort of suspender buttons on them, because you were meant to buy them pretty big and wear them over your other clothes as a protective layer in the mines or what have you. And same with Lee. One of the earliest, most successful things that they did were these denim coveralls, which was essentially this, you know, what we think of as a boiler suit. And again, it was for mechanics. It was for people working on cars that get all of this kind of grease and oil and everything. And you have to realize cars are pretty new at this point in the early 20th century when we're when it's first developed. And so, again, it's meant to be worn over a uniform by a chauffeur or worn over day clothes. So it's very protective. It is not designer. It's not cool. It's not rebellious. It is workwear.
Right.
Full stop.
Then we enter the 1970s, right?
Yes.
And this was a huge turning point for denim, and specifically the jeans industry.
Yes.
Why so?
So actually, I think the 1970s is when jeans go mainstream. And denim becomes just everyday clothing, you know, and it's not just jeans, as you say, it's full suits. It's, you know, people get shoes made out of denim. People have bathing suits made out of, it's a whole thing. It's a denim moment. But leading up to that, it's really, again, the counterculture movement and the hippies of the 1960s who bring jeans into the mainstream and bring jeans into the living rooms and into the stores around the country. A pivotal moment in this chronology is Woodstock. because Woodstock was televised. It was reported on, you know, images of the crowds that were at Woodstock. It was this cultural event. And so many of the performers and also the concert goers were wearing jeans. Now, you know, many of the performers and also many of the attendees were wearing very trendy jeans, you know, both bell bottoms that had been bought at Army Navy secondhand stores, but also at, you know, things that had been acted upon and DIY'd and stitched and ripped and patched and all that. But then there were a whole bunch of people who were just wearing Levi's 501s, you know, and this was such a pivotal moment to the point that the following year, Levi's used an aerial shot of the crowd at Woodstock as an ad. And this was a tipping point into pushing the counterculture, the hippie movement, into the mainstream, and the style of the hippies getting co-opted by fashion. You know, it's important to note that denim clothing in general for the hippies was a tool of protest. It was a tool of resistance. They dressed in a particular way as a symbol of their political outlook and as a rebuke of the post-war consumerism and the disposable culture and plastics and industrial military complex that they thought were kind of killing the environment and destroying culture, destroying the world. And then it's in this moment, as we get into the early 70s, of the hippie movement going mainstream, where their distinctive look that they had created gets co-opted, in a sense, by one of the very industries they're protesting against. Right. So jeans explode across the market at every level. You have Yves Saint Laurent for his Rive Gauche line creating denim safari jackets. And you have full suits for men, leisure suits made in denim. And then, of course, you still have the jeans. And you even have the big three, you know, the Levi's, the Lee, these companies that have been making workwear, trying to get in on the game. And they create bell bottoms.
Right.
And they create, you know, these sort of crazy psychedelic patterns. So it's a real tipping point.
So in many ways, these high fashion designer jeans were pretty much the antithesis of the denim workwear of the 19th
century.
This is not what we're talking about anymore. This is full-on fashion system. Run amok. And jeans were not the only appearance that we see denim in high fashion. There were some other early adopters. Claire McArdle comes to mind. What is the place of denim in the context of that in this American ethos of quote-unquote American fashion, not American workwear?
So it is important to point out that beyond jeans, there's been a long sort of cross-pollination between denim and workwear and fashion. And as you say, Claire McArdle is key. Also, Bonnie Cashin is another key person. Even couturier Elsa Schiaparelli kind of dabbled in this aesthetic using chambray. Is, you know, barring the Schiaparelli example, which I think was more sort of surrealist and sort of putting opposing, you know, juxtapositions side by side. With McArdle, you know, she looked to denim for its durability and for its workwear when she created her popover dress in the 1940s. And she was unveiling it during World War II as this practical garment for the fashionable housewife to wear now that she was forced to do her own chores around the house. Because during the war, the Rosie the Riveter figures, the women who went and worked as part of the war effort, were by and large from the service sector. So now you had these socialite figures who, heaven forfend,
had to—
They didn't have help anymore. They had to scrub their own bathtubs and, you know, they couldn't wear their couture while they did that. So again, McArdle is creating her popover dress. So you even have in the name, it's a sort of wrap style, but it's popover. You're meant to put it over as this protective barrier over your other clothing. And it had an oven mitt that matched, that it came complete with. But and Bonnie Cashin also dabbles with denim, you know. But with both of these, what Bonnie Cashin's doing is she's creating a beach ensemble out of denim. And there's this whole genre of quote-unquote play clothes
that
are coming out
period.
In the interwar period and into the 50s, where it's clothes for sort of leisure time when you're going to the beach, going for a cookout when you're maybe in the garden. And denim was very popular. Denim and chambray were very popular in that genre. So what we see with both of these instances, the popover and the play clothes, is this notion of occasional dressing.
Mm-hmm.
And so denim was okay and even fashionable as a form for a particular type of situation. You're cleaning.
Right.
You're going to the beach. But you're not going to wear this to the office. You're not going to wear this out on the streets in the city. You're not going to, this isn't fashionable dressing, everyday wear. That's what happens in the 70s. That's the tipping point. And so now again, we see dresses, suits, all these things, and the jeans. But now you can wear them anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a huge, huge moment. And of course, by the end of the 70s, this gets really solidified with figures like Gloria Vanderbilt.
Of course.
And Calvin Klein.
Jordache.
And Jordache coming in with the stiff, dark, high-rise, very sleek. This isn't your hippie denim. This is sleek and stiff and chic, high-end.
And tight.
And tight. Sexy denim. Right. And again, it ushers in this notion of it's not just every day now. Now it's really aspirational.
Yeah. Cut to today. and there is some serious aspirational denim.
Oh, yes.
Out there on the market.
Dress listeners, whatever your reason for wanting to learn a new language, whether it's an upcoming international adventure, communicating with your friends and family abroad, or even professional purposes, Rosetta Stone has got you covered.
As the trusted expert in language learning for 30 years now, you can join millions of Rosetta Stone users to learn any of the 25 languages offered. That includes Spanish, French, Italian, German, Korean, Chinese, Japanese, Dutch, Arabic, and so many more.
And this is fast language acquisition, friends. There are no English translations, so you learn to speak, listen, and think in your new language. And right now, you can get lifetime access to all 25 of Rosetta Stone's language courses for 50% off. That's language learning for 25 languages for the rest of your life, which, Cass, is frankly amazing.
It is. And what are you waiting for, dress listeners? Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, dress listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
Dress listeners, did you know that you can save on everything from fashion to beauty, home decor to groceries, even kids' school supplies with Rakuten?
Rakuten is a shopping platform that partners with over 3,500 stores across every category. Beauty, clothing, electronics, home, department stores, pets, you name it. You're already shopping at your favorite stores, so why not be saving while doing it? It really is a no-brainer.
How does it work, you ask? Well, stores pay Rakuten a commission for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the commission with its members. You get paid via a check or PayPal quarterly.
Membership is free, and it's easy to sign up. So join the 17 million members who have already saved at their favorite brands. Start all your shopping at Rakuten.com or get the Rakuten app to start saving today. Your cash back really adds up. That's Rakuten.com. April, Mother's Day is just around the corner. Do you know what you are doing for your mom this year?
I sure do. This year, I'm gifting her My Life in a Book, which is this very cool service that will allow her to turn her life stories into a beautiful printed book, complete with her own photos of significant moments in her life.
Yes, this is so amazing. And dress listeners, here is how it works. So once a week, mylifeinabook.com we'll send your mom a question via email, and these can be pre-written questions about her life or any custom questions that you wish to ask, and then your mom can either type her response or she can use their voice-to-text feature, and mylifeinabook.com compiles all of her responses into a beautiful keepsake book.
So join us and check out mylifeinabook.com and use the code DRESSED at checkout for 10% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's mylifeinabook.com and use the code DRESSED for 10% off today.
On last week's episode, I interviewed Dana Thomas, and we mentioned just really briefly this quote-unquote cult of denim. And we talked about how just like there are self-professed sneakerheads, there are also self-professed denim heads.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about the contemporary artisanal denim scene? And what are some of the techniques that we are seeing being used? And also, I guess my last question was like, what are some of the price points that some of this rare artisanal denim can command?
Yeah, I mean, the denim head culture is a rabbit hole in the sense that it's very narrow vocabulary of products that you're looking at, but it goes deep in terms of how many companies, once you sort of start
like pulling the thread.
You just realize how big this subculture is, you know, and how obsessive it is, you know. And there are brands that don't have huge wide distribution, but have cult-like followings. This is something that really started in Japan. So Japan, after World War II and during the Korean War, a lot of GIs, you know, and army, U.S. Army troops were based there. And they would bring their jeans. And, you know, because of the popularization of Hollywood and all these kind of culture sources, jeans were unobtainable there. They weren't being sold. And so GIs would sell their used jeans to this up-price market in Japan. And that really kind of continued through a secondhand market. But then eventually, getting into the late 70s, into the 80s, Japan starts to see a rise in domestic denim companies that are all about trying to recreate this quote-unquote authentic historical denim of the Levi's 501s and the Lee Riders and all this stuff. And they're doing it down to the kind of twist of the thread.
Wow.
They're taking apart vintage pairs of Levi's, copying their patterns, copying them down to the stitchwork. For the exhibition I did actually a few years ago, we acquired a piece from one of these nascent labels called Studio D'Artisan. And it was a pretty much direct copy of a World War I era pair of Levi's 501s. And what I found most fascinating about it was that the double arch stitchwork on the back pocket, it's called the arcuate in the denim head kind of world, was actually not stitched. It looked like it. When you got up close, you realized that the stitch marks had been painted on.
Why?
With yellow, you know, kind of gold paint. And it's because during World War I, there was rationing.
So and you couldn't use extra thread.
You weren't allowed to use thread for decorative elements. But Levi's was so dedicated. You know, Levi's is just a fascinating company. But Levi's was so dedicated to its branding and its logo that it decided, how about that? We're going to paint it. You know, we're going to paint that double arch stitching. And so this Japanese company is reproducing it down to the painting. So eventually this reaches beyond Japan. You know, American companies, Scandinavian companies start to crop up. Nudie Jeans is a big label in here. And one thing that starts to happen in this market is also the idea of raw denim, which is another kind of subset of this obsessive connoisseur culture, which is raw denim basically means denim that has come kind of straight off the loom and is made into pants, into jeans, as opposed to denim that has been stonewashed or pre-washed. And now we hear stonewash and we immediately think of like terrible 80s jeans that are acid washed and crazy looking. But the reality is almost every pair of jeans you're ever going to buy in a store are stonewashed. All it means is that they're washed in industrial size washing machines with little pumice stones. And based on the amount of wear and tear, how soft you want the jeans, you will go through however many cycles, the stones will be however big. There's a whole, again, rabbit hole subculture of these wash houses out in LA, all around the world, that it's this science, really, of how they get these different effects. But raw denim is so stiff. It's so hard. People will go and get it, and they don't really know what they're getting into, and they put it on, and they're like, oh my God, this is so uncomfortable. And it's like, yeah, this was workwear.
Yeah.
This is how it was.
You gotta break it in.
It was designed to be a protective layer. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have to break it in. But labels like nudie jeans, they were, you know, key in thinking about this raw denim movement. So you go and you get it. And the idea here is, again, about authenticity, right? This is the real denim. And again, I would say, I would problematize that to say that there's all different ways of looking at what's real or authentic. But the notion is that you personalize it yourself. You wear it, and you wear it for a year without washing it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it starts to smell, you're supposed to put it in a freezer. All sorts of things. And then after you've worn it, you know, almost every day for a year, and you've really started to get it, you know, broken down and feeling soft and worn in.
For your body,
and
too.
For your body, exactly. Then you wash it. And it's at that point that that first layer of the blue dye really comes off in the wash. And all of a sudden, you get those wear patterns that we're so used to seeing on jeans reveal themselves. And there are examples. You can look these up online. There's crazy examples of a guy who kept his iPhone in the same pocket every day. And you'll see the outline. And you'll see where his knees are. You'll see, you know, the whisker marks is what it's called, the sort of horizontal wear pattern that comes out, that emanates out from the fly.
Mm-hmm.
That's called whiskering. And that's from sitting. You know, sitting and your pants pucker. So there's all these things that will give a sense to the body. So there is this interesting dichotomy in jeans, where on the one hand, they're one of, if not the most homogenizing garment on the planet. As you said earlier, you can go into almost anybody's wardrobe and find a pair of jeans. But on the flip side, they are also something that is highly conformable to your personal body. And this notion of having your favorite pair of jeans is often about these personalized marks, these signs of being lived in, the signs of a life cycle,
mm-hmm.
of experience, of individuality, that are why we love denim so much.
Emma?
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Oh, yeah. No, it's my pleasure.
I think you, once again, gave our listeners a lot to think about. And I think that the next time that they pull those jeans on.
I know. There's so much to talk about denim, too, because I will also just, if it's okay, add just a close that with denim, you know, there's also the flip side to all this positive stuff, which is that denim, since it is such a huge market, and since there are so many companies producing denim out there and so many people buying denim out there, it is a huge pollutant too. Because, you know, as I was mentioning, these jeans, even before they hit the store floor, are getting washed mm-hmm. multiple times. Think about the water that takes, the pollution that causes. You're polluting the water because they're getting pumped full of chemicals and rocks and all sorts of stuff like that. Then you have individual laborers sort of shaving down the jeans with sandpaper or sandblasting.
Dana and I talked about a little
bit.
Yeah,
so it's just, you know, as with everything in the fashion industry, when we talk about process and industry and global reach, there is a double-edged sword.
Mm-hmm.
So not to end on a sad note, you know, denim is great, and I love denim, but it's something that I hope we all, just as consumers, get more educated about what's in our closet and where it comes from. And how it's made and what the real impact is of it. Because denim is one of the most ubiquitous garments. And as one of the most ubiquitous garments, it also one of the most problematic.
Right. It's going to have a major impact no matter
major,
what.
Major, major impact. So just keep those jeans.
That's right.
Keep them. Hold on to them. Keep, mend.
I have a pair in my drawer right now that are my current favorite, and I think I've mended them like 3 times.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's so true.
I just keep patching them up.
Yeah. And I mean, jeans are also another space, you know, echoing stuff from the previous time I was on your show. Jeans are also one of the places that get talked about the most in terms of sizing. mm-hmm. and in terms of bodies and in terms of fit. And I do think that there is a side of this too, where the body that jeans were originally made for, this sort of male body, has led to problems in finding cuts of jeans and in thinking about jeans for a range of body types.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for joining us again. Yeah. And you know, I'm going to hit you up to come back and talk about your power show at some
point. Yes, absolutely. It would be my pleasure.
Where can people find you if they are interested more about your work?
Yeah, so I'm at the museum at FIT. We've got a lot of content on our website and on our YouTube channels. We do a lot of public programming. And we even did some stuff for denim that's on there if you want to kind of go and look in the past. And there's a digital version of the exhibition there. I'm also personally on Instagram. So you can follow me at Emma McClendon. But otherwise, you know, I encourage you guys to come and check out the museum the next time you're in New York, because we're free and open to the public and always have something on view.
Yep. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thank you so much for joining us again on Dressed, Emma. You know, April, my husband is, as you know, very into small batch denim culture.
I know.
both American and Japanese. So some of his favorite brands include Blue Blue Japan and Japan Blue. Those are both small batch Japanese denim brands, but there's also a lot of American made brands such as Flint and Tender, Imogene and Willie, Brave Star, Gustin. These are all American made jeans. And it's a pretty incredible commitment that he has with his denim. You know, he gets this brand new pair of dark blue indigo dyed jeans. And over the process of 6 months to a year, he wears them in until they gradually fade into, you know, this kind of faded blue. And they actually become fitted to his body. So in order to not compromise the integrity of the indigo and the garment, he only washes his jeans like once every 3 to 6 months, if that.
I know. And I love this idea of personalizing your jeans through the practice of wearing them. You know, jeans are a very haptic garment. This is my new favorite word, by the way, haptic, meaning how something feels to the touch. And we all know when a pair of jeans feel great and when they also just really aren't working for your body, you know, and then breaking them in and creating the patterns of wear specific to your body by the way that you move in them. I don't know. I find this a very romantic notion.
It is very romantic. And Sean looks quite good in his blue jeans. I'm going to say that too.
Speaking of romance.
And while we're on the subject of denim, April, I wanted to actually tell you about this new, you know, kind of project I've been embarking on. And it's with upcycling my used denim. You know, I think we all kind of have this tendency to throw out things when they get holes in them or when they wear, you know, and especially, you know, if you're someone like me, like the middle of my thighs wears out immediately. And you can have a seamstress fix that. But I have this like whole batch of blue jeans that have just been sitting here waiting for a project. And so I literally cut them all up, April, and I wove them into rugs.
Oh, fun. That's awesome. You'll have to post some photos.
I will. And it's, you know, it's surprisingly simple, dress listeners, to make your own hand weaving loom. The one I use is just a piece of square wood and you just like wrap the twine around it and weave. So I'm having a blast repurposing my denim and I hope our listeners will too. And that actually, April, that does it for season two of Dressed.
I can't believe it. Time flies.
You know, and I just want to say, April Callahan, that I really appreciate you. And I, having done this for 2 seasons now and having known you for the past, 9 years, this has been such a treat and a joy. And
wow.
I cannot
wait. I love you too. I feel
the
same.
For season 3. Yeah. You know, thank you for being my partner in all things fashion history.
That's true. Yes. And may it continue on for many, many more years.
Yes. So dress listeners, may you consider the romance of denim and maybe even upcycling your old denim into your wardrobe next time you get dressed. A huge thank you to all of our listeners out there that made this show such a success the past 2 seasons. We look forward to having you join us for season 3, which will launch the first week of February.
We'd like to wish everyone a happy and healthy holiday season and a happy new year. Here's to 2020 being a year of change, fashion related or otherwise.
We will still, of course, be active on our Instagram feed during the hiatus. So if you'd like to submit a question for a fashion history mystery for season 3, you can DM us at dressed_podcast, or you can also email us at dressed@iheartmedia.com.
And an extra special thank you to our producers, Casey Pegram and Holly Fry, for the last 2 years of their work on Dressed. We love you guys, and thank you so much.
Yes, much love to Casey, Holly, and all of our listeners. We will catch back up with you in February. Cheers. Dress, the History of Fashion, is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you listen to your favorite shows.
Ready for a career in behavioral health? Earn your online degree at Herzing University. Choose from health and human services, psychology, or social work programs. Gain the skills to work, coordinate, and manage nonprofits. Secure a bachelor's in psychology to study mental health, or advance your social work career through our online Masters of Social Work. Let us help you become a social change agent. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Text HEALTH to 85109. That's HEALTH to 85109. Or visit herzing.edu.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.